from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. Paul Farmer first went to Haiti when he was 22 years old, a country he would come to call his greatest teacher. A few years later, as a young doctor, Farmer co-founded Partners in Health to serve Haiti's Central Plateau. In the past 25 years, the organization has grown to serve not only Haiti, but Rwanda and other impoverished countries around the globe. In his new book, Farmer writes that too often we fail to think about helping the poor because we're anesthetized. The book is called To Repair the World, and its goal is to wake us up. Paul Farmer, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this morning for Michael Krasny. The poor, Paul Farmer notes, shoulder the greatest burden of disease, but don't receive an equivalent amount of care. That's, of course, because availability of care is governed more by who can pay than who's in need. And yet, as Farmer pointedly observes in his new book, I've yet to meet a poor person in Haiti or Africa who says, "Don't bother, Doc. I don't think care for me is going to prove cost-effective." Paul Farmer is best known for his work in Haiti, Rwanda, and elsewhere through Partners in Health, the organization he co-founded 26 years ago while still in medical school. His new book is a passionate argument for changing the healthcare equation. And that won't happen, he says, when you just offer help from a safe distance. Instead, you have to go the distance to live, work, and partner with those in need. A journey, he writes, that will invade you, change you, and drive you to act. Paul Farmer is the co-founder of Partners in Health, also professor at the Harvard Medical School. His latest book, again, To Repair the World. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
I want to ask you about your writing this book that is composed of speeches that you give to largely graduating new doctors. Why do you put so much effort into those speeches? Who are you trying to persuade, and what are you trying to persuade them to do?
Well, first of all, thank you for noting the effort. I mean, it takes a while to if you're writing an article or a book for a scholarly publication or your peers, that's a very different process. You know, if you write something about an infectious disease and how to treat it, you're talking to a very small, you know, community of people who are going to understand what you're saying about, let's say, dosing of an antibiotic. Or in another field I work in, medical anthropology, it's a small community. But when you're trying to talk to everybody who's becoming a physician or a nurse or a frontline worker, it's a very different effort. I'm not even thinking about the fact that these are commencements and their grandparents and parents and spouses are all there and children. And so it takes a little bit of stepping back and saying, well, how do you – if one thinks, as I do, that the question of health disparities or how poverty – affects health outcomes is important for everybody, including all practitioners. If you think that's true, how can you engage with them as they start a very busy life as often they're going to off to internship, working 80 hours a week. They don't have time, they think, for the big picture. Things like access to healthcare insurance, how having trouble keeping up with your rent check, or paying for public transportation or private transportation to get to the doctors, how that affects the doctor's medical services. They don't have time, and yet they need to make time. So why do I write them like that? Well, I'm trying to persuade an entire next generation, not only that they should be interested, because they buy that by and large, but they can be interested in meaningful ways.
You're evangelizing to a degree.
Yeah, you know, the word comes up a lot. And I mean, I think it comes from good news, and that's fine with me. So the good news is that we have technologies in medicine and public health that can change the fates of hundreds of millions of people. That's good news. And the less good news is we need to understand a lot about those people's lives if we're going to make these tech services available. And finally, that we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to fight a little for the right to health care, all of us, no matter what our leanings might be, if we want to be effective as doctors, nurses, and frontline workers of all sorts. And of course, as I've said, I believe that's really true for our species and not just the healthcare professionals.
What you just said about how central it is to understand people's lives is something I'd like to ask you more about, because you return to that point in the book and in these commencement speeches that you make often, this idea that you can't really bring about change unless you spend time with other people, that on your way home, that young intern or resident, go to your patient's apartment building and learn something more about who they are. Why is that principle so central to this process of change you want to bring about?
I think that one of the reasons it's so central is because I'm never sure about it. That, I think, well, you know, on the one hand, everywhere I go, whether it's a prison in Siberia or a squatter settlement in Rwanda or Haiti or Boston, one of the big teaching hospitals, everywhere I go, the chest x-rays look pretty much the same. Or the lab results look the same, or the, you know, physical examination of the patient is the same. On the one hand, there's that. But on the other, there are the stubborn particularities of people's lives, the social and economic and cultural conditions, if you will, that make this specific knowledge sometimes less well applied, if not less applicable. And so I end up coming back to the points that I learned in medical school and in graduate school in anthropology. You got to listen to the patient, that we'll have no technologies replace that action of listening. And I'm just saying that if you actually go into their lives and homes, you'll be able to listen almost more rapidly. If you could listen more rapidly, you'll learn more quickly, because then everything's kind of laid bare.
And is it because then you ask the questions that need to be asked that you might not ask in the office? If you ask questions like, well, can you get this prescription filled, or whatever the question needs to be that will really have in the end a direct impact on how someone's going to be able to lead their life?
That is one of the major reasons to do this kind of social medicine or home visit, no matter what you're doing, is to find out and to learn about what these forces that you wouldn't see necessarily inside a clinic or a hospital, what they might be. Another, I think, is to learn how limited we are from a place like a clinic or a hospital when we're talking about, for example, chronic disease. And that may lead us as a profession or a series of professions to think hard about, well, who else can we work with who right now is not part of our professional circle? For example, community health workers. Because we're not saying to doctors and nurses, or I'm not, you should go to, do home visits all the time. I mean, unless you're a visiting nurse or, a hospice doctor. There's some of our colleagues, actually, that's what they do, is home visits. What we're really saying is learn to have the humility to understand that we can't do this without a lot of partners in the families and in our patients, but maybe also in community health workers.
Tell me something about how that approach has made a difference in Haiti, the country that you always refer to as your greatest teacher. How has that approach changed people's lives?
Well, let me just say that a good example of how it really works to improve outcomes. There are lots of ways of talking about improving outcomes. You could talk about value for patients, cure rates. They basically are the same thing, right? Some diseases aren't curable, but you can still expect better outcomes if we have effective therapies. And I could talk about diabetes, AIDS, tuberculosis. The way I learned it, and many others have too, it's not meant to be an original insight. The way I learned of the really impotence of medicine without community-based care and community health workers was in Haiti around tuberculosis care. You can have free diagnosis and free access to medications, but these are treatments that you needed to take every day. In fact, back when I started almost 30 years ago, you needed to take these medicines for 18 months. So, for example, if you're setting a fracture in a clinic, you don't have to wait 18 months to see if you set the fracture right and if it heals. But that's a long time. And so all the social forces that I've been talking about, they come into play in the course of that treatment. Well, we had really bad outcomes. And so you had to ask, well, why? Was it because, as a lot of the doctors and nurses seem to think, was it the patient's fault because they were superstitious? Or, I mean, you hear that here in California too. You'll hear people say, well, these patients have strange beliefs. They're not like ours, meaning the doctors will say that. Is it for those reasons that are in the patient's mind and culture, or is it because of all the structural barriers to getting to back and forth to the clinic to get your medicines or whatever? And so we did a study of that, and I think it wasn't a bad study, and it was a good study. And it showed us pretty unequivocally that if patients didn't get well with that disease, it wasn't because the patients weren't good enough, and this ought to make you smile. It was because the program wasn't good enough, that we weren't getting the medications to those patients in a way that was convenient. Of course, the same story plays itself out with epilepsy, AIDS, diabetes, et cetera, all these chronic illnesses for which we have decent diagnostics and therapies. And so my challenge, my summary is this, that unless we find a way of working with others, including, of course, as I said, patients and their families, but also other professionals, health workers, we're not going to be able to deliver good care for chronic disease. And guess what? That is what we're facing in this country as well.
In Haiti, there's been so much written and reported about how all of the resources that were gathered to try to assist that country after the earthquake 3.5 years ago, that so little of it in the end seems to have made a difference. Is it because of that factor that not enough is being done in partnership? Haiti, as everyone probably knows, is so often referred to as the Republic of NGOs. Is it that those non-governmental organizations are not engaging in that way of providing assistance?
Well, you know, I want to not sound like I'm being too critical of NGOs. After all, I work with one or two or three or four. That is, you know, I'm pushing for NGOs and their involvement. That said, the question that one can ask is, have we added up to the sum of our parts? There are so many of us, right? And for a particular patient or community or family or children in need of going to school or a school lunch program, for example, and I know you've had some experience there as well, you can say, yes, we have done our job. But when you look at the totality of the effort, the resources, the energies, the passions that have gone into Haiti and through various groups like this, I would say, no, we haven't added up to the sum of our parts. So the next question might be, how could we do more and do better? And I think, yes, long-term engagement in partnership is really important, not just partnership with local communities, but also partnerships with, for example, if you're in public health, you really don't want to work with the public health authorities. If you're in public education, which, by the way, most education in Haiti is privatized.
Not, yeah.
But don't you want to care a little bit about the public education authorities and teachers who are struggling with so little in the way of resources? And I'm not saying it's easy, but that's why we keep using this term accompaniment, because it requires long-term engagement. You know, the experience we've had in Rwanda, where there's been such a turnaround over the past decade, to me, that's a very short timeline. In only a decade, you can see a doubling of life expectancy. That's stunning. It's mostly not like that. It's a long-term engagement.
Tell me more about how that happened, because the statistics about Rwanda that you cite in your book are extraordinary. The huge drop in infant mortality and in maternal mortality, the change of the poverty rate from 80% of the country to 45% of the country, or whatever it is exactly. If you rattle off the statistics and say, what country is that? Most people aren't going to say Rwanda.
That's,
I mean,
right.
How did that happen?
Well, let me just say again, with, I hope, some humility, that you can bet that there are going to be a lot of competing claims of causality just to explain the success. I mean, same as with explaining failure. And that, of course, what happened in 1994 was one of the most colossal failures of humanity, right? I mean, the genocide in Rwanda. So just as there are lots of competing claims of causality for what happened then, there will be, you know, arguments about what caused what. And I'll just say that you know, maybe what I'll be proven wrong, but I would say it is a combination of several factors. And a lot of them have to do with a good plan. That is a plan for recovery from the genocide and the economic devastation that followed. And just to go to the health indices, Rwanda was probably pretty much the poorest country on the face of the planet in 1994. Highest infant mortality, I mean, deaths due to camp epidemics from cholera, malaria, to say nothing of the slower pathogens like AIDS and tuberculosis. And, you know, death and childbirth, for example, a clear report card on a health system. It was, let's just say, at the bottom of the heap. But to get out of a mess like that, you need some kind of coherent plan. It isn't always the right plan. It has to involve economic recovery, things that to me are not that interesting, like how do you collect tax monies? But also, what about housing, public safety, you know, food insecurity, clean water? It's, very difficult to come out of chaos, even when there hasn't been war and genocide and the horrible legacy that always leaves behind. So I guess one of the things I'm saying is they did develop over the course of the next few years a plan. And I would say it was a plan that had some equity built into it, meaning it focused on poor people and rural people and recovery. And the specifics of the plan are important. Another thing that I would put on the top five, let's say, list is you have to have good leadership. And I've worked predominantly with the health authorities, and I know that there are very competent, committed Rwandans who wanted to see their country flourish. Another is, again, back to our Haiti discussion, how do you bring all of these groups together from humanitarian groups with short-term goals to development partners with longer-term goals, medical authorities, et cetera? How do you bring them all together to make us add up to more than the sum of our parts and thereby complement the Rwandan plan for recovery, which they called, by the way, Vision 2020. And then there are inputs. You need staff and stuff, right? You need to do our work. I mentioned doctors and nurses, of course, but you need community health workers. You need supply chain, logistics. That's the staff. You need the deliverables, the stuff. You need hospitals, clinics, medicines, vaccines. So it's a complicated endeavor. And it requires not just a good plan and, you know, some hope and all those other ineffables. It needs investment.
And you also write that the problem with most plans isn't the plan. Often the plans are good. The problem is implementation.
That's
it's
right.
Sticking with it.
That's right.
And
I'm glad that you elevated that, because I don't want to forget that important part. You know, people... You know, they assume that the leadership isn't good or the plan is lousy or everyone's lost and confused. But sometimes there are decent people. In fact, mostly I would say, and you know, I'm not forgetting the genocide or the coups in Haiti or the, you know, what happened in Guatemala for 30 years. I'm not forgetting that. But often there are good people, smart people, and they often have decent plans, sometimes excellent plans. And, you know, you got to stick with the delivery, the implementation, and that takes a long time.
And you're also making the argument that you have to be there, that you can't just help from long distance. You can't just send a check, as good, important, and as useful as that is. You're really making the argument that this argument of accompaniment, that you have to be with people.
Yeah. Well, you know, the ways of being with people vary enormously. That is, you know, a doctor has one way of being with a patient. A manager has one way of being with a supply chain group. You know, a health minister or senior health official has another way of being with her staff. But I think it's true, nonetheless, that accompaniment requires some kind of presence and proximity. And, you know, obviously, I was lucky enough to be involved in Rwanda for 10 years, and it was pretty, you know, remarkable experience. Another reason I think proximity is important is we're all, you know, we're flawed as a species. We forget things. We, you know, we're not mindful. A lot of people, unless they're some kind of gifted empath, need reminders of what the stakes are in these struggles, this struggle for, you know, life and death and well-being. So I think finding ways of being there is important for everyone. And that may be even the person writing the check, he or she ought to be able to be there too and be part of this partnership idea. I mean, again, I just was in Haiti a few weeks ago and we opened this big medical center. And I felt so grateful and proud of what had been done by my colleagues and friends, but the partnership required to build a major teaching center in the middle of Haiti after an earthquake required inputs from donors, tech companies, electricians, unions, and lots of people who cared about rebuilding Haiti's medical and teaching infrastructure. That we wanted everybody to be part of that partnership.
And part of what you also suggest can change and is important to change is to think about the way in which we work in partnership in a different way. You cite the example of the Red Cross, for example, paying part of the salary for people who work at General Hospital in Port-au-Prince. That's not – you normally think of going and NGO goes and they create their own little entity as opposed to saying, well, you're already there. You need people to pay your salaries. Let's do that.
Yeah. It's a hard sell, right? Because quite understandably, NGOs and foundations and other groups might say, well, that's really not the job of our institution. That should be the job of the Haitian government to pay public sector employees. And, you know, you can understand the arguments for that, but what happens if that argument goes on and on over decades and there's not enough resources going into a place like the General Hospital, and suddenly you're standing there on the day after an earthquake when these buildings all around the hospital have collapsed and some of the hospitals collapse, and you hear, well, the nurses and doctors can't show up, or the other staff, because they don't have the resources they need, and they're not being paid. And you know that the craziness of that situation gets laid bare in times like earthquakes. I mean, I could go back to the question of the Boston Marathon bombing and say, well, what became clear then? It became clear on that. To a lot of people in that city, Boston, that we needed our teaching hospitals and that there's a reason no one who made it to a hospital like the Brigham where I work or the Mass General, no one died. Haiti needs those things too. Mm. And so back to the American Red Cross example, I'm very grateful to the Red Cross for listening to this argument. Look, your MO might be to help non-governmental organizations and others in humanitarian relief, but the public sector's got to have some part of this too. And we can need 20% of their employees may have died on that day of the Ministry of Health. That's some of the numbers that we saw. We didn't know what was happening in the middle of the earthquake, but we knew it was bad.
And to your point that on the day of the Boston Marathon, lives were saved. The good news is how effective now medical care can be. The challenge is making sure there's an equitable distribution.
That's right. And, it's not an elegant way of putting it. Where's our equitable distribution plan? Where's our equity plan? But, if you compare, what happened in Boston, I mean, I think, again, I'm quite proud of our hospital there. And I think we have reason to be proud of the teams that took care of those patients. But I must say that it is not difficult to receive 200 patients at once in those hospitals.
And would be, of course, most other places.
Most other places in the world.
Paul Farmer, our guest, his new book is To Repair the World. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so right after our break. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. More with Paul Farmer and To Repair the World when we return. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. In today for Michael Krasny, Paul Farmer is our guest, the co-founder of Partners in Health. His new book is To Repair the World, a series of speeches that he's given to graduates, new doctors, as they are about to go forth into the world. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. You mentioned a moment ago, Paul Farmer, that you were in Haiti just a few weeks ago. You keep coming back. I think I understand a little of that, having been to Haiti a few times on both reporting and volunteer efforts myself. But talk to us about what sticks with you about Haiti, why you keep going back, why you believe, as daunting as the problems are, that if you keep going back, life will be different?
Well, the reason is I've seen it get different, as it were. I've seen a lot of progress in the years that I've been lucky enough to work with my Haitian colleagues and American colleagues mostly over the last 30 years. And I mean, this hospital experience is very profound for me emotionally.
Getting the hospital built in the Central Plateau.
Yeah, because that's the town. I mean, this is a silly reason to add, but it happens to be the town where I went when I was 23 years old in between college and medical school. And I saw that year and in the years right after a number of tragedies which have stuck with me my whole life. They tragedies of not of people I didn't know, but of people I knew well, you know, young people my age who, you know, died in terrible circumstance and of reasons that I'd not seen before or later. I never saw, you know, typhoid in Boston. I mean, I'd seen a case of typhoid in Boston, of course, because we have in that same hospital I mentioned, the Brigham, we have the ability to diagnose typhoid pretty easily. But I'd never seen it kill anyone, never seen malaria kill anyone in Boston, although I'd seen lots of bad cases and of people coming back from malaria areas. And I'd never seen anyone die in childbirth. So, you know, that was, for me, as a physician in training, young man, that's when I said, you know, I'm gonna do this for the rest of my life. This being work on health disparities, and I did it in, you know, my own way, meaning as an infectious disease doctor, but working with, again, huge team of people, a lot of community health workers. So one of the reasons I go back is because I said I would, but you know, say all kinds of crazy things when you're young. But another is because I enjoy the work. And Haiti is a place where you can make a lot of progress, actually. I mean, I can't imagine building a major medical center in San Francisco in less than 3 years. So, having already bragged about the Boston teaching hospitals, I can't imagine that we'd need to build another medical center in Boston or that it would be easy to do in 3 years. We, you know, with this partnership and accompaniment approach, we finally brought close the loop, at least on the quality of the infrastructure in that one city.
Would you tell the story? It's a story you tell in one of your graduation speeches. It's the story of Thomas Clarkson and his horseback ride after he'd written his essay about slavery. And this is when? Middle of the 19th century?
I mean, I stole the story from Adam Hochschild, who I'm going to be with later on tonight. We're doing something together later on this evening. And it's a great story in part because Adam Hochschild wrote it in a book called Bury the Chains. My students who are listening will be rolling their eyes saying, Paul always talks about this. I do, because it's an inspiring story of a young person just graduating from college, riding his horseback, you know, to London, who's written an essay as a student about slavery, the slave trade. And he said, he found himself just stopped by the side of the road. And Adam Hochschild tells this so grippingly that he suddenly sees that he's standing on the road beside his horse. And I think most people have had that experience where you just stock still and you're thinking about something so profoundly that the rest of the world has kind of dropped away.
And what he's thinking about is the essay that he wrote in academic language,
Latin.
Quoting in Latin. And he's thinking, what if that's true?
Yeah.
What if that's true?
Could this be true?
And then what do I do?
And
now
then,
what?
No, from what Hochschild says, he says, well, if this is true, then surely someone must do something about it. And he became one
that's
of those.
Someone's.
It's a team.
And is that what you are wanting
those
young doctors to hear, that they can be that someone?
It's exactly what I'm wanting. Sure. And I believe it. And it's not just that I want it. I've seen it happen over the years. You know, the way people, it's so intimidating to get involved in this kind of work. By this kind of work, it may be the fight for, you know, other kinds of security beyond the social safety nets I describe, you know, education, healthcare, thinking about complex social problems and goals, like having a planet that's just, that isn't going to collapse because we're trashing the environment. Whatever the goal is, those are very intimidating. And people, in my experience, will say, as I did, well, and as Clarkson did, but how can I get involved in such a daunting problem? It's very legitimate and necessary part of the process. So, I love that story, which Hochschild tells better than anyone else has.
And it's also about thinking about the individual difference you can make and not necessarily worrying about, well, will this change everything?
Yeah.
It's thinking about, well, here's what the single thing I can do. I'm not going to worry about whether how this sits on the overall metrics of change. I'm going to think about this one thing.
Well, I think what the genius of Hochschild's retelling is that he doesn't suggest that one person can make a difference. What he's, you know, by being one person, Thomas Clarkson say, he suggests that one person can make a difference by joining other people all trying to make a difference. And that may be a small group, as it was in the case of the late 18th century. It may be a small group of people fighting the slave trade and slavery itself, but that group can grow. And, you know, I just, in my own professional experience, to have been involved in this work for 30 years and to see what has happened over the last decade around, for example, AIDS treatment in a place like Haiti or Africa, and it's, you know, it's been stunning. And, you know, if there are people listening from this city who have been involved in the AIDS activist movement, let me just say as a doctor, hey, thank you so much. I say it as often as I can because the fight for global health equity or for health equity is never going to go away. But the fight to convince those who control funding resources and manufacture, for example, the medications and diagnostics we need, the fight to convince them that we simply must do something effective about AIDS in Africa for people already sick, I think we don't have to keep fighting that. We have to keep protecting the advances we made. So again, you start perhaps with a small group of people. They may be directly affected by the problem that we're talking about. In the case of Clarkson, of course, he was joined by a number of former slaves. In the case of people living with HIV, there may be a small group at first, or people who survived breast cancer or some other problem that's initially seen as personal, right? But it's also really a social problem. You know, that's been a pretty exhilarating thing for me to see the progress we could make in just one decade, not just in a place like Rwanda for a lot of problems, but specifically around, you know, just treating people who are already sick with a certain disease.
Paul Farmer, the book To Repair the World. Let's take your calls. Shane in San Rafael. Go ahead, Shane.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And it's really an honor to be on the phone with you, Mr. Farmer. I've read your books and found them very interesting. I spent some time in Haiti over the last year and a half. I have much less experience than you do. I spent three different week trips. And one of the things that I just wanted to really highlight and underline what you said about going there and accompanying your efforts and your money is really important because it was eye-opening, troubling, and really very inspiring and really made me much more grateful for my day-to-day life. So that was very important. And I wanted to make a comment, this comment question about NGOs. What I heard from the locals down there talking is that the NGOs come down, and with the donations, they end up dumping a tremendous amount of resources into the local market. They dump food, you know, rice, materials. The Red Cross brings down its own labor. They buy their own bulldozers and bring those in. And very few NGOs engage with the local economy. So what happens if you're a bread maker or a guy who sells cereal, which is a specific example given to me, is that you can't compete with free rice and free grain. So while the NGOs are down there dumping resources, they go out of business. And there's not the same thing with the Red Cross. They're not engaging with the local economy in a way in which they're using their money to employ people and to build businesses. And
Shane,
so when you leave, there's there's nothing left.
Yeah, Shane, thank you. Thanks for bringing that point to us. It brings up something that I wanted to read that you point out in your book about where the money has gone, and this has to do with humanitarian relief, that 34% was provided to civil and military donor states, 30% was provided to UN agencies and international NGOs, 29% to other NGOs, 6% to in-kind recipients, 1% to the Haitian government. That's a really stunning statistic.
Yeah, it is stunning. And, you know, you could argue, and Shane, I'll return to your point in a second, you could argue that after such an enormous disaster that affected the nerve center of Haiti, that it was almost impossible to pass resources through a crippled government. But that's an easy, you know, an obvious thing to say. And what if it was not 1% but 10%? You know, what impact might that have had on helping rebuild Haitian institutions? And I don't cast aspersions on the motivations of a lot of the people who showed up. I mean, I was there too. I remember how much goodwill there was and is. But as Shane pointed out, you know, the metrics by which we evaluate ourselves in either humanitarian relief or in development work ought to include how are we strengthening the local economy, local institutions, how many local jobs are we providing? Again, how can we promote real recovery? And that we haven't been tough-minded on that yet.
Betsy in Oakland has our next question for Paul Farmer. Betsy, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Farmer. It's actually not a question. I just wanted to thank you for a patient that the last patient I saw, I spent a week at the MediShare Hospital in Port-au-Prince right around the elections, the Haitian elections, and I had a boy that had a tumor growing out of his eye and couldn't get any help, and I got to the Port-au-Prince airport and was put in contact with one of your colleagues. And he arranged for the boy with a visa to get to New York, I think it was. He had a surgery, and it was an incredibly wonderful story, and I've always been indebted to you and your organization. Even though I've never been a volunteer for Partners in Health, I would love in any way to volunteer. I'm a nurse practitioner, so I just wanted to say thank you, and I love the work that you do.
Betsy,
well,
thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Betsy. I'll just add, it's so great to have follow-up and to be able to share with my colleagues in Haiti and in Boston who helped arrange that. And just a good chance to note, as I'm sure you feel as a nurse practitioner, it would be great, of course, to be able to manage those kinds of complicated medical cases in Haiti. And that's where we need to head. And it'll happen. We just have to take this accompaniment approach.
How do you respond to kind of the other side of this question of volunteering in Haiti? And I've wondered about this personally because I feel sometimes that in my own experience there that it did me more good than perhaps the good that I did, that we sort of go in a way to our own sort of personal reclamation as opposed to assisting others.
Well, you know, it's a as the years go by, you know, I hope I develop more, you know, subtle ways of thinking about this. It's the subject of quite a bit of that book. On the one hand, we all have this quest for personal efficacy. We want to feel effective. This is what Martin Luther King talks about in the Drum Major Instinct, which is the inspiration for one of those chapters. We all want to be, you know, seen as the good guy or feel effective, whatever, and that's human striving is neither avoidable nor to be avoided. The question is, how do you harness that and other sentiments that may not be the most important ones, and they can include empathy, pity, compassion. Again, I think we need those to live in this world together. But how do you harness those unstable sentiments, as Susan Sontag's termed them, into building systems that can protect people from harm? And that may be, you know, what happened in Boston on April 15th, or it may be an earthquake, or it may be a sudden change in the in the international food markets where unfair trade practices end up hurting Haitian farmers, as Shane mentioned in describing dumping things on a market. To move from one to the other is the perennial mm-hmm. challenge of, you know, being human and being exposed to problems like this. I think we should not deny that quest for personal efficacy, but we shouldn't be so quick to laud it either. Like we say to most graduation speeches, they say, oh, how great you are, and you're like the first day of Harvard Medical School. I heard, you know, you guys are the best in the world, you know, individual striving and achievement. Well, you know, then you find out that being a doctor or a nurse, as Betsy said, is not about individual achievement. It's about working with a team to help other people, not yourself.
And is the value of, you quote Dietrich Bonhoeffer as saying you have to find the view from below, and that the value of that is not only then how it changes you, but is what you do with that once you've seen things from below.
And again, as I get older, I have just more and more, I hope, sympathy for people who are not themselves from poverty, who grew up with some kind of freedom from want, that is the young people I'm speaking to in this book. When they see this view from below, it's frightening and it can be upsetting. It is upsetting. What am I saying? It can be upsetting. But as Bonhoeffer said, you know, understanding what people are thinking when they're looking at a problem or their own condition from the poverty or being mistreated, you learn something very important. Now, Bonhoeffer was hanged for it by the Nazis. So I'm not suggesting that, you know, that's the outcome any of us want to see. But to learn that, as Martin Luther King did, as, you know, Oscar Romero did, as Bonhoeffer did, all martyrs. But you don't have to be a martyr to learn this. You can learn this no matter where you're from and where you are. And you could do it right here in our own country, too.
Number of questions, emails, Facebook posts coming in. We should get to Ang asks, with a projected rise of cholera, what upcoming precautions and preventions are planned in that area? I assume he's talking about in Haiti.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question, and there are long-term and short-term plans, right? We talked about plans earlier. And let me just say first the long-term plan. The long-term plan needs to be building what some people would call water security. That is, water and sanitation programs that can reach everyone in that country and on that island. And, you know, if you look at the Bay Area, as I was saying yesterday at Stanford, you know, you take a sip of water, you don't expect that you're going to get cholera. There is a system in place, and part of that is public, right? I was drinking tap water. And how long does it take to build that? How long does it take to build water security and modern sanitation? It takes a long time. You look at the big cities. Look at San Francisco in 1900. Epidemics of plague and other problems. The reason that we don't have them now is not because less crowding, but because we have better public health systems. And that's not a waterborne disease, but you know, you take cholera in Boston, Philadelphia, London. The reason that cholera has gone from those cities is they have modern sanitation. So long-term goal, I think we know a lot about what needs to be done just looking at the previous epidemics of cholera in the Americas. I was in Peru at the tail end of one in the 90s, early 90s. We know what to do, and that would, of course, wipe out other waterborne pathogens as well. The short term is actually much more complicated because we have new tools to diagnose and treat cholera, some of them super simple, you know, oral rehydration for most patients probably. We also have new cholera vaccines, oral cholera vaccines that we need to work all of those tools into the short-term response if we want to prevent cases and deaths in the coming 2 years.
How do you keep from getting discouraged?
Well, I didn't say that I do always keep from getting discouraged. I think, you know, that's part of this work. But I don't know if maybe people who are bankers get discouraged. I don't know. You know, I think, again, that discouragement arises in all kinds of pursuits, right? But I think actually this work is, there's more insurance against discouragement if you're doing work with, that is having some kinds of success as we'd measure it, you know, decreased infant mortality, et cetera. I told you the example of Rwanda or building a hospital, but also you're working in partnership, hence the name of the organization.
Yeah, exactly what I was going to ask you is that the odds for sticking with it, which is so much of what we've talked about, increase not only in efficacy, but also in keeping you in the game if you're not doing it alone.
That's right. You know, I was at Stanford yesterday for a reason, because that was the school where FACE-AIDS was founded in 2005. And I knew the students who started it, you know, some of them 18, 19 years old. And like a lot of discussions with students, and again, this book is directed largely to them, people have questions, well, why, you know, this, why is, you know, AIDS ripping through Southern Africa? Why are these people that we're working with on AIDS prevention dying? And the answer, of course, was because they already have AIDS and they need treatment. In the time since 2005, this group has raised $2.5 million of young people. And it's spread across the nation and other nations. And again, it's easier to stay in the game when you've got, you know, the bench is full of people like these, you know, younger folks who are helping us with the work.
With that, we must pause. As you know, this is a fundraising period on KQED. If you'd like to find out more about that, you can visit kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. Let's take another call. Paul joins us next in San Francisco. Paul, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a doctor, and one of the great developments in AIDS was an article published in the Townsend Newsletter for Doctors in the year 2000, in which they pointed out that AIDS in Senegal, West Africa, did not exist, and a couple doctors spent a couple of years trying to figure out why, and what they figured out was Senegal, West Africa is the largest deposit, contains, the soil contains the largest deposit of selenium in the world. And originally when AIDS was diagnosed, it was called AIDS because it was an acquired immune deficiency of selenium syndrome. And they were correct in the beginning, and now, years later, we discover that AIDS can be prevented, as in Africa it is being prevented, using selenium. And
I'm going to hold you there, Paul, just to get Dr. Farmer's response to that observation.
No, I'm not really familiar with it, and I'm sorry to my colleague. My own area of interest is in is of course in prevention and care, but particularly in addressing disparities of access to any technology shown to help those you know, already affected or at risk of that and other diseases. And I'm sorry I haven't been able to keep up with. I wasn't familiar with that. I think in Senegal there actually is a burden of active HIV disease, AIDS, and why it is not larger, or why it. Than, let's say, in Southern Africa, you know, some of the first factors that I'd mention is there's enormous disruption of families in Southern Africa for labor migration. So if you look in South Africa, which has is both the wealthiest country in sub-Saharan Africa and has the highest burden of HIV disease, it's marked by very profound social disparities. And again, enormous, just millions of people moving around in search of a job. And you know, again, I don't know what the selenium levels might be in the soil there, but I know that that kind of movement and disruption is almost always associated with higher rates of HIV transmission. And, you know, the other area on that continent I know pretty well, as I mentioned, is East Central, where, again, there's quite a bit of HIV disease.
I want to just ask you last about a quote that you reference a time or two in the book. It's so simple and so powerful. And that's the Martin Luther King quote, which is that everybody can be great because everybody can serve.
Yeah, that is surely my favorite line in the book. And it's from his speech right before he was killed, The Drum Major Instinct. And there's a reason that Coretta Scott King played that at his funeral. It's the mature Martin Luther King. And he was fighting for, again, health equity and, you know, for poor people, not just in the United States and not just, you know, but everywhere. He was asking hard questions about the war in Vietnam. And, you know, like Bonhoeffer, he said, look, we need to understand the view from below, even though the drum major instinct is in all of us. And that is such a powerful peroration. Anybody can be great because anybody can serve. I believe it.
And because it harnesses that desire so many of us have, that drum major instinct to be out there and lead, but it recasts the question that the way to achieve that is by accompanying people, by serving.
You know, a model of leadership that makes room for accompaniment and that says part of it is building or helping to build platforms so others can lead would get us out of a lot of trouble, I think, in looking at, for example, how to improve medical care in this country or elsewhere, how to rethink foreign aid. You know, they may be simple ideas, but they're important first principles as well.
Paul Farmer has been our guest. His book is To Repair the World. We should also note that he will be speaking at the Norse Theater in San Francisco tonight at 7:30. It's an event hosted by City Arts and Lectures. Paul Farmer, great pleasure to meet you. Thank you for being on our program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online assistance from David Marks. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Tomorrow morning on Forum, we'll take up the question of healthcare availability in California. Today is the day when the new plans out through the healthcare clearinghouses through the Affordable Care Act are being published. We'll talk about that and what that will mean for Californians tomorrow morning on Forum. This is Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.